Hi, friends. Welcome back to Healing the Divide. I am grateful to be welcoming you back if you have joined us for episodes in the past. And if you're new to this show, I want to take just a quick moment to say thank you for being here. It's an honor to share these conversations with you. Conversations into themselves are really powerful vehicles for unpacking the deeper potentials that dwell within our shared human experience. In so many ways, our conversations historically in the public sphere have been limited to 30-second clips and tidbits and news bites and talking points. And there's something that's unique about the long-form podcast format that really speaks to my soul because it supports for deeper nuance, more substance, profound connection, greater clarity, and really a deeper opportunity to go deeper into subject matters. On this podcast, we explore the idea of healing the divide where that exists within us, where that exists between us, and where that exists amongst us as a collective. But it's not only within the human-to-human experience, but even in our relationships with other spheres of being and life itself. And one of the core fundamental experiences to being alive is our relationship to eating, our relationship to food, how we energize and take care of our systems. And I know for me, that journey has been a little bit of a roller coaster, and being able to explore all the things that can intervene and interject into the relationship with food and how to let that become a healthy one. And so really healing the divide in our relationship with food, our knowledge around how our bodies uniquely interact with the food that we put into them is an area that I think we're all still learning and growing and figuring it out. So I'm happy to enroll the support of somebody I deeply respect in this field, Megan Fahey. Thank you so much for being with us on this journey today. And I'm excited and honored to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to just share this topic and be in conversation about something that feels so deeply meaningful to me as well.
Thank you so much. And I can hear, and I'm sure our listeners will be able to hear as well, just even you saying hello, you can feel your heart and sincerity. You can feel your enthusiasm. And I know you have so much knowledge and wisdom to share from your studies and your experiences professionally and in your own human journey. So if it's cool with you, I'd love to just take a moment to share an introduction and let our listeners and viewers have a little bit of background on your approach to this work.
Absolutely.
So Megan Fahey is a registered dietitian, integrative and functional nutritionist, and registered yoga teacher. She holds her Master of Science in Nutrition and Dietetics from Bastyr University, one of the country's leading schools for integrative medicine. Megan's nutrition sessions artfully blend Eastern and Western healing modalities to help clients break free from patterns of disordered eating and restore balance in the body. Her self-guided online program, FedWell, was developed to provide comprehensive guidance from the comfort of your home to become sovereign and empowered in your relationship with food. As a frequent traveler, avid reader, and amateur chef, Megan has an endless curiosity about the intersection between nature and culture. Absolutely amazing. So much to dive into. And I would love to kick us off by gaining an understanding, I think, first and foremost, if your approach to understanding the relationship between a human being and the food they put into themselves is something that can be objectively understood or is better tailored as a subjective experience. And I wanted to lead with this question primarily because I think it informs the orientation to are listening to this podcast. So many of the podcasts that I listen to about food, health, wellness, nutrition are focused on these particular protocols that say, do these things, eat this way, fast in these hours, eat in this order. And then I write down everything and I wonder, like, is that true? Is that true for me? Is that just true for the other person? Is it based on study? So for somebody that works with people and it might support people in how to listen to this conversation, what is your approach to the relationship between human beings and the food we put into our bodies?
This feels like the million-dollar question to start off with. You know, as you were asking about this idea of objective and subjective, I was thinking I often will approach sessions with like the physical. So what are the structural patterns that we can put in place with the food? And then the kind of emotional psychological relationship, which is maybe the subjective, like how does that energetically align with your body? And I really think of our relationship with food as an energy exchange. And so in that approach, it's an approach that also requires us to be more connected to nature, the nature that we live in. And that's where it becomes so subjective. Like, yes, the objective structure could be timing of eating. What could balance of the plate look like to balance your blood sugar? But where are you located? And what is that food that's around you to connect you energetically with your season, the energy of the earth in your environment? And so that's maybe the first example that I came to. Another one that came to mind in this exploration of objective, subjective, or like form and function is male and female physiology and the hormonal differences. And oftentimes, you know, I work primarily with women, and oftentimes when I'm hearing these kind of rote dietary recommendations, the piece that's really missing is where is a woman in her cycle and does that recommendation align with her body hormonally? So not only environmentally, where are you located, but where are you in your own physical cycle? In a man's body, I'm looking more at circadian rhythm, which is also in a female body, but all of these are nuanced differences throughout the calendar year. And a lot of times when diets are presented in a rule-based format, we're missing this ability for someone to really become sovereign and empowered in their own alignment energetically. And I think that's a big part of the conversation around food that really gets left out in the way that we present it in our kind of diet culture rule-based focus.
Yeah, it's so much like what works versus what works for me and figuring that out. And I would imagine it'd be almost like my approach to speaking with you today is to lead with curiosity and see how our body responds to particular approaches. And I'm wondering, given that you have sort of, it sounds like, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but less of a strict protocol that you're putting people into, but more like adapting the protocol to the variety of elements that you're taking in about the particular human being, how do you approach your assessment or intake process?
So I have, I would say, kind of a general framework of structure for how to approach it. And actually developing the program Fed Well was a really great personal assessment for me of like, what am I doing? And what is kind of this general guide of how someone is journeying through this work? I would say classically, we're going back first. Childhood relationship to food, cultural relationship to food. This is really informing a lot of our beliefs around food and body, even into adulthood. And so looking back at that foundational connection and our family rules around food, I can learn so much about where this work is going to lead you. And one of my favorite prompts to start with is a writing prompt to sit yourself at the table as a child and just reflect for me, what is around you, both physically physically, like what's the food served and what's the energy? What is the dynamic of that table? How does that feel for you? You're consuming all of that. And that is setting you up for what food means to you and what food means in relationship for you as you grow up. And from there, it's such a richness that comes out. And we're really working on unraveling some of these beliefs that you've now identified that do not serve you. You're also identifying whose rules are these? Were these my mom's rules or my dad's rules? And how did they hinder my relationship with my body? And from there, once we're reclaiming your relationship with food, then we can start to get more attuned and aligned to the foods that actually serve you. So I would say that like sets off the path. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I leaned off the counter a little bit to grab my pen and write down a sentence. And then you just said the sentence to finish the, which was wild because I thought like, oh, that's what we should call this podcast. And what a great program too is the food that serves you.
And I love that.
Because you know, it's so much about like, what food do we serve? But it's really like what I'm hearing you say is, what is the food that serves you? And I wrote down the food that serves you. And then you said the words, the food that serves you. That's a whole thing right there. That you take it and run with it, you know? I mean, we could spend the entire time together unpacking what's inside of what you just shared. There's so much richness and depth. There's so many places I want to go that are beyond what I even prepared with my questions for you. So if it's okay with you, I'd like to take a moment to linger. Is that cool?
Absolutely.
Okay. So of course, subjectively speaking, I was trying it on as you were saying it. So I put myself inside of my family of origin, inside of a kind of suburban, middle class United States of America. I was born in 1975. So my memories kind of kick in, you know, circa early 80s, being a little kid, you know, memories kick in maybe 4 or 5 years old, 3, 4 or 5, you know, when I think about eating, what I can even remember. And I know we're consuming more than we remember, and we're consuming more than the food. But that's what I really heard you say is like, we are ingesting the energy, we are ingesting the emotions. And our brains that aren't yet fully developed. I mean, this is a conversation about somatics and psychology and all of it. And I look at being in context, the youngest of three. So learning to kind of be quiet, and maybe I wasn't getting fed. I was the more shy, kind of withdrawn one. So the food became a way of exchanging, of interacting. And food was a time where we were all together for dinner is what I'm thinking. And, you know, and there was probably about 5 or 6 years there before my parents got divorced. And then that totally changed to like microwave lasagnas once it was like mom's not working, and or I'm like coming home and cooking like steakums on the stove for myself. But before that, it was like, I can think of these big, like, I don't even know if this is a proper term, but I'm going to call them ham steaks. They were like giant hams. And, you know, and there'd be like big things of mashed potatoes. There was a lot of like heavy comfort.
Yeah.
Rich. And then knowing that there was this subtle sense of trajectory towards divorce that was happening. But when it came to me and we'd go around the table and who could speak, I would go like, well, I did this in the morning, and then I did this, and then I did this. And they would always laugh at me because I would like recount my day, and my sister would bring her sticker book. And it was where we gathered. And so there was a lot there, I think, not only around how it got wired in, but when there was the divorce, the ending of that gathering. And since it got wired, I'm guessing around that was the exchange that occurred for emotional connection. And then there was a rupture in the family unit. my way of fulfilling myself, or literally filling myself emotionally, was to turn to food. And to be totally honest, I've never made any of that connection until it's literally coming from your voice to my brain and out of my mouth in real time right now. So I'm already blown away and in gratitude for knowing the questions to ask. I've never thought of that before. And I feel like I need to take a breath. So anything that you'd like to add in, I am all ears.
So I should have started the podcast saying what I often say to new clients, that speaking about food can bring up even more than what comes up in a therapy space. There is something so visceral about the experience of food in our bodies and talking about the energy of that and the memory of that. And oftentimes I'll feel clients get caught off guard with how much can rush in when you're thinking about these memories at the table. And so I could have started there before we dove into the question. You can feel, right, how much comes up in just that. And this empathy with, oh, that's the role that this played for me. When I'm working with parents of a young child, I often use the analogy of the plate for a kid is like a microcosm for how they interact with the world. And so if you're noticing patterns with how they're interacting with their food, it's really useful to reflect on that. Well, is it being used as a comfort or a soothing? Maybe there's a rejection of something that's happening and there's a rejection on the plate. Food, even though it's not maybe consciously understood as a child, it's the one thing that you feel like you have a sense of control over. It's your one thing going into or not your body. And so there's a really strong relationship there. And then it continues to play out, I guess, unless it's really assessed or looked at, or in my case, it came to the surface in a way that I had to do work on it. I couldn't be engaged in my life without figuring out, How do I live in connection with this thing that has caused a lot of pain from a young age?
Are you open to sharing more, or does that feel too vulnerable?
Yeah, I've gotten more comfortable sharing in session spaces as well. You know, it's interesting as you were describing that relationship at the table. For me, it was the opposite. I was the oldest child and a family of all boys. I have three younger brothers. Yeah, I know. As you were talking, I'm like, wow, we were like flip-flopped, inquisitive and sensitive child, and really understood the world in an emotional way without an emotional language to figure out how to exist in this kind of sensitive nature. And I have a very loving set of parents, and our house was run in a very kind of rules-based manner. And when I was kind of questioning or rejecting internally the rules, I also learned to reject everything that was being fed to me. So I don't know if I want to consume that. I'm not sure if I believe that. And I'm going to cut everything off. And I think in some ways, looking back, it was also an anxiety management. Like there was a lot of internal anxiety and angst and emotion. And consuming anything on top of that felt like too much energy. Again, I did not have the words for this. All I knew at the time is like, this food feels like too much. Exactly. Just this kind of cutting off. And so that then played out and became quite tumultuous. And what I struggled to find was an intervention that blended both the eating disorder approach to food, which is a very fear-based approach. And what I mean by that is there's a fear that has happened in connection. You've cut off your food, or you're consuming it and purging it, or you're consuming it in a very numbing kind of a manner, all of which are disconnected with the body. And so we want to heal that sense of fear. And by doing that, we're going to get rid of rules around food, work on exposure to food. So repetition, kind of like an OCD exposure, repetition to help with the fear. But there was not a thoughtfulness around what that food itself is, the energetics of the food, the therapeutic qualities of the food. And so the flip side of kind of that eating disorder-based approach was this integrative and functional approach. And what I found in that side of the spectrum is that while there was a real thoughtfulness about quality of the food, there can be a lot of judgment about food. This is good. This is bad. This serves you. Damaging, cancer causing. Like, there are very harsh words being used in connection with some of this functional approach to food. And so my journey really brought me to this space of like, how do I figure out how to hold both sides of the spectrum? Because one without the other didn't feel like the whole story.
In the sense that on the eating disorder side, that there's not something necessarily bad or wrong, but there's like like what comes natural to you. I'm trying to suss out the benefit in the disorder side that you're blending with this sort of non-judgment on the functional side.
Yeah, I think the benefit, oh, that's a good question. I would say the disordered eating side is what taught me that my thoughts and my beliefs about food I was consuming mattered. That was the connection that was made for me, that our beliefs about food and body are actually really healing and really important. And the food can be on the functional side as healthy, you know, quote unquote, as possible. We could eat just greens all day, every day. And if there's this sense of self-hate and disconnect from that energetically, it's not serving the body. So does that speak to the question from the disordered side?
It really does, because it's funny, I've been remarking in the last couple of weeks in the unfoldment of this podcast, where the through line is healing the divide, that in every instance, every context that I explore this idea within, the same pattern reveals itself, which is that there's typically an unhealthy relationship with a particular experience of our humanity. And then in service of overcoming that unhealthy relationship, we move towards an overcompensation pattern that denies some sort of inherent value within the experience in the way in which we were having it. And when we sort of, I don't like this saying, but I'm just going to use it anyway for a moment, but like throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's like, you know, it's like, wait a second, there's a middle that we can come back to that, as you said, holds both, and either way can be out of balance. That extreme, rigid, just only eat this way at this time all day is kind of its own trauma response. And until we learn to really integrate, I mean, it's funny that we're calling it integrated and it can be so suppressive, but and integrate what comes out of us naturally. And that what I heard you say in the response to my question is there is some innate value in the subjective relationship one holds within food. And then it's with food. And then it's about dialing that in to the healthy expression, to the healthy relationship, that it's not all this and none of that, or none of this and all of that. And that means and requires that we have mindfulness and presence and real time noticing about how we are in relationship with food, not as a once and for all, but because if our emotions are impacting our food, and our emotions are always changing, and if our beliefs are impacting our diet, and our beliefs are always changing, and our body is impacting our food and vice versa, and our bodies are always changing, it implores us to be present with the exchange that we're having. And that is an invitation into aliveness, with the very thing that is the source and sustenance of us being alive, which would make sense. And so just, wow, again, like the ahas are lighting up for me.
I'm so glad this is being recorded. As you're talking, I'm like, oh my gosh, I want to listen to what you said again. So beautifully reflected. And we had a conversation early on when I first moved to Florida that I loved when we were reflecting on this idea of that pendulum and how there's value in both sides. There's value in the rejection of the rules, and there's also value in the discipline within us and the rules themselves. And so I love how you use the word integrated. Like, we want to integrate both of those polarities, and it is this continual aligning and realigning. And of course, that's going to be ever evolving. And so to think that it's one way, we do such a disservice to our relationship with our bodies and with our earth.
Because then we're living according to a standard in our mind rather than the experience that we're having in the moment that we're living. So it yeah, absolutely. So this all said, are there common patterns that you observe? Yeah, I understand that we're all personal, but since we're working towards this integrative aspect with the universal, are there particular universalities that you experience in your work where you'll see somebody share and I understand the pattern, the contours of the road that you're traveling?
My first thought, and I'm just going to go with this, the analogy that first comes to mind that I often use in session is a bow and arrow. Most of the time when someone is coming in to see me, there's already a sense, unless it's a child being asked to come to see me, there's already a sense that something isn't quite balanced here. And I use this bow and arrow analogy because the tighter we pull back, the more restrictive those rules, the more disconnected we feel from our own body being free with our food, with our movement. Then when we let go that arrow, the tighter we were holding. And I use that in description of relationship with food because I'll either get someone who's so pulled back that there's almost like it's become like a shell of themselves, the way that their body feels. And it's like, I do not, and you use the word aliveness, I do not have a vitality in my sense of being because I am so pulled back. I can get a client who is swinging from one to the other. I'm so restrictive during the day and then finding myself in these really frantic patterns of eating at night. Again, the restriction is the etiology of both presentations. And a lot of times we as a culture, I think we've learned to shame the overeating, like that there's something wrong with that. And we still have this kind of puritanical way of worshiping the restrictive side, like, oh, well, that's good. That's better. We put that on a pedestal. But this bow and arrow analogy, I think, is helpful because if we just put it down, if we would let go of this need to hold on to white knuckle, to restrict, that your body then has the opportunity to start to regulate. And of course, I can help put hunger fullness can get very askew through years of dieting or just disconnection from the body. But that restrictive nature, whether it's mental, meaning like I'm eating throughout the day, but I'm telling myself I shouldn't be, or I'm eating these foods and I'm telling myself they're bad, or physical, I don't allow myself access to these foods. And then when I'm in connection with them, or I've shut off all connection with them, and therefore shut off a lot of connection socially or romantically, because food is such an important thread. But that, when you were asking about a universality, I think that would be my best way of capturing it, is it feels like there's this restrictive desire, like I should be, I use that in air quotes, more restrictive or better. And then it either plays out with this kind of deadening or cutting off of the body or this reaction to it because our bodies weren't meant to be held that way.
It's so interesting. I love that that's where you went with it, because it's the should, to whatever expression it takes. is the core of the inherited ideas, the inherited habits that have gotten normalized in our systems. And I know that in the work that you do too, that is a nervous system experience as much as it is anything else. And I can liken in my own journey the experience of the nervous system aspect of it to working in my coaching work with people that are integrating their trauma. And as an example, I can totally relate to what you said, because I can feel, and there's a whole body image element of this too, but like I want to restrict in some way because I didn't move my body as much today. So I need to start restricting my calories because I don't want to gain too much weight. And so that's not too healthy. And then it's like, so I'm going to limit the bows, getting tighter, tighter, tighter. Okay, fuck it. I'm starving. Now all of a sudden, like I'm going to go eat. And my biggest fear is there won't be enough. So let's order like two appetizers. And then there's the financial, like, I don't care what it costs. Like, we're going into a different brainstem. Oh, it didn't even cross my mind. Is this healthy or not? Like, I almost forgot that it's like a different brain experience. It's like in a trauma vortex, we lose capacity or access to our prefrontal cortex, particularly the medial prefrontal. And so that executive function goes offline and we're in the heightened amygdala response. And it's as if something shifted and it's like activate eating. And then it's eating, like there's not going to be enough. And then, you know, it's an hour later going, oh my God, I ate way too much. I can't even move. I got to remember, I don't like this feeling. And then boom, it goes again in this cycle. And then wanting to remember the after and go, you know, wait a second, how do I know I think I want that, but how do I break the habit of believing the belief that I actually do, that future me will be like, high five, good decision, when maybe it wasn't. And so when that is like an uncoupling of a neural pathway, and just to really see that this is like the neuroplasticity of eating. And it's profound, because if we can do that here, now we're training our nervous systems to do it in all these other spaces as well.
That is such a great term, the neuroplasticity of eating. And what I often will hear then is this shame story around what's wrong with me. Like, is my body broken? Why am I eating like this? There is such a sense of failure connected to eating in that way. And I really appreciate how you're likening it to a trauma response. There's such an emotional experience there. And so if we can have empathy for like, oh, I wasn't even operating in my prefrontal cortex. Like, I did not have that on board in this experience, partially because my blood sugar was so low. My body was designed to do anything it needs to get food when it needs it. Like, I often will think of Maslow's hierarchy. Like, we cannot self-actualize when we're starving. Mm. We just can't, like, that's all we're going to think about. And so this pattern, if we can soften the shame voice and the judgment and the what's wrong with me, and actually look at, wow, I was so hungry and I hold my body in this energetic pattern. I restricted so much that I left myself no option, and start to really reflect on that and have this capacity for neuroplasticity. Like, what's a different outcome here? What's a different belief I could start to adopt in order to change these patterns? That's where you start to break into the cycle or put down the bow and arrow.
That feels like such a great segue into the next part of this conversation, to explore the relationship between our beliefs and our food and our beliefs in our body. So this idea of breaking the shame cycle and not using the awareness, the new awareness that's arising, as an opportunity to double down on a pattern that is debilitating us, and use it as an opportunity to acknowledge ourselves for becoming aware in this space that it's historically been difficult for us to have awareness and start to really like turn the tides of momentum in our favor. And I wanted to ask, you know, in terms of this shifting the habits, what are some of the beliefs or the habits or the patterns that you find most effective in empowering people to A, be on their own team in terms of their inner voice, but even more specific and practical, like what are the habits and the practices that maybe you give your clients when they're leaving sessions to practice on their own?
So this would be another one, a kind of another step through these prompts. We started with sitting at the table, reflecting on what are those beliefs and maybe who did they come from. The next step to that is starting to challenge the belief and create new ones. And so one of the tools I really like, I'll call it eating disorder versus healthy. I often encourage clients to name the voices, like my inner critic and my wise self, whatever you want to call them. But jotting down, okay, what are these limiting beliefs about food? What are the shame-based voices? What does the judgment sound like? And jotting down those thoughts, and then taking each one and reframing it. What would be my reframe here? Sometimes when I'm working with someone, depending on where you are and how painful this relationship to food can feel, that can be a very frustrating process. And oftentimes I'll hear, I do not have a positive response to this. And so we look for neutral. So if food is really painful right now, and the belief is that I do not want to eat, like I've heard so many clients say to me, I wish I could just take a pill. My relationship with food is so painful. I wish I didn't have to have one at all. Then we're going to look for neutral. So I need food to sustain my body. That might be your reframe. And then how you then implement the tool is when these kind of shame-based or judgment-based voices are coming up, you're noticing them and you're pulling out this sheet. I often will have clients take a picture of it on their phone so that they can reference it throughout the day. What was my reframe to that? And that's how you're starting to build a new set of beliefs, because we cannot change your patterns, your behavioral patterns, without the beliefs shifting. And so that I think is a really great tangible way to look at the beliefs and then reframe them in order to create this new operating system, almost like a computer. You have to give it a new, you have to kind of like provide new software for it to work differently.
This is really fascinating to me as an inner work coach, because a lot of the processes are paralleled. And it's funny because I'll often hear myself say we can change the content. You know, the process is very similar. So I want to try that out for a moment and reflect back some of the ways that I might support somebody in integrating aspects of life that they're challenged by, and see out of curiosity if the methodology superimposes naturally.
I love that.
That would be kind of a fun thought train to ride for a moment. So one of the things that we do is we start off by really, as you said, unless there are children, they're usually coming in with a recognition of that idea of limiting belief. You know, a lot of times it's not serving me anymore. And I try to hone in on the word anymore, because I think there's something beautiful. And I actually started, this is not with any judgment, this is just my own subjectivity. I started like pulling out the word limiting around limiting belief, because I felt that it felt into itself, maybe it's like a neurolinguistic thing, but like it felt like it was hard to, like there was such an emphasis on restriction that it was inhibiting the forward movement. It's like reinforcing this idea of limited. So I started inviting this concept of switching the word limiting to survival. So I have a survival belief, or I have a learned belief in even a more neutral sense or usage of the word. So I've just learned this. It's very, I'm not putting a judgment on it one way or another. It's just a learned sort of survival mechanism that I've encountered. And then moving into this phase of like connecting to choice, do I want, not do I want to get rid of it? Because I've noticed that in the idea of getting rid of it, the reason it's there is because to some age of us, it is coping, it is surviving, it is serving, literally in some way. And until we can integrate the part of us that is picking up that particular tool or that particular habit, they won't feel safe in setting it down. And so it's been important to say, we're not going to just toss the thing that you think you need to feel safe. So if I just say, if I put it into a food context or an eating context, it might look something like, we're not just going to change the way you eat, because that's going to feel super threatening to the part of you that eats to feel safe. So let's look at the idea of talking to that part of you and what they're actually trying to get from it. So if we use like me as the example in the story I shared of like, there's emotional connection. So then I know, okay, well, food is the surrogate. It's the stand-in for emotional connection. So let's start to like develop more emotional connection in other spaces. So there's not a threat of loss there. And then that makes it easier to sort of release the white knuckling, but that advocacy doesn't get imposed in an authoritarian way upon that part of me, but rather it's of that part of me's agency and own choosing. They become their own advocate to say, well, this would feel like emotional connection. And, oh, here's another thing. So I let them connect to choice. And then when we move beyond connecting to choice, we go into what we call like vision articulation, which is, well, what I would really love, because now there's like, can think bigger and go, I would love to, you know, have energy from my food. I would love to not be restricting or overeating, but being in healthy reciprocity with it. And then there typically that survival or learned belief will like whoosh back in pretty quick fashion and go, yeah, but. And so there's this piece of this called an empowering declaration, where you create a sentence prompt or stem for them to fill in that holds both. This is that integrative element, I think, that we were speaking about, that the stem is like, while it's been true that my relationship to food is painful, and I often hear myself thinking, I would rather just take a pill, or I wish I could just take a pill, comma, it is also true that, fill in the blank with the rest of the sentence. And then inevitably, it's like, I want to learn to be more healthy and balanced and harmonious and kind in how I think about eating and how I eat. And so it groups, it takes that blockage and links them together, creates that neuroplasticity and puts it in motion. And then from there, we go to vision activation. So these are the things we'll do. And then vision affirmations, like what we can remind ourselves is our internal practices, and then into vision sustenance. How do we support this, not as perfect, but as practice? And then try to really celebrate I don't even want to say like the wins, but any time when we can have an outcome that is different than the one we thought we had, or that we thought we were going to have. So if I can have one meal and remember the after, like, oh, I'm going to feel so full, let me switch to this instead, that the rewiring that happens in real time, then there's the nervous system sort of somatic reset that's occurring, which is deeply supported by what I'm hearing you say, which is that belief work that we can have. And I see so many trauma coaches penduluming all the way over to mindset doesn't work. And it's just about the nervous system reset. And I'm like, that they're not antithetical. They're aspects of our nature. To the degree that we can sit here in a non-triggered space and objectively understand what's happening to us, that we can resource ourselves with compassion, with a new belief work, of reformulating our understanding around what's occurring, and fortifying those places of understanding, that gives us, in my understanding, availability, a little more space, a little more capacity, a little bit more resource to just intervene and do that one thing a little differently. And then the wiring of the nervous system starts to default and reroute around this new habit that we're implementing. And now we're turning those tides. So my question is, how does all this land for you? Does it superimpose into this space?
Yes. I'm almost laughing as you're talking because I'm like, you just healed the divide of my prompt and really brought it back to the intention. You called it an empowering declaration, that statement. Like, what a beautiful way to acknowledge both sides. And I really appreciate this acknowledgement of the way that this has served me. Mm-hmm. These practices, these behaviors that now cause me pain at one point were my mechanisms for survival. And like, so,
thank you. Not like screw you and we're done with this, but thank you for keeping me safe when I didn't know how to feel safe. Like, what if I couldn't pick up that bite of food and I was just left suffering? Like, thank God my nervous system was wiring to like do something for me when I didn't know where else to find connection. It's like, it's heartbreaking to me to think we're just like trying to shame ourselves through healing work.
Like, there's such an emotion to this conversation because with that compassion, now we can bridge the two. Now I feel like I want to bridge the two and almost like holding hands with both the part of me that like really needed those behaviors and the part of me that's like, you know what, you're ready to not remain stuck in them or surviving with that. I was just going to say limited. And I'm like, no, I want to rephrase that to remain in survival mode. You know, I had a client in my office yesterday and she was so funny. She sat down and she said, Megan, I'm surviving, not thriving this week. And it's such a sweet way to reflect on like, I got stuck in these habitual patterns that my nervous system used to know really well. And I want to go beyond that. And I really appreciate that statement, this declaration that encompasses both. And it's such a beautiful bridge from one side of the set of beliefs to the other in a way that helps you feel safe enough, I think, to get there.
Yeah. Well, I can't take credit for it. I have to, it's like to give credit where I've heard and learned tools from. So that is from my coach trainer, Amy Lombardo with Brilliance Academy. And she taught me that. And I found it to be so therapeutic in my own journey and with people that I have the privilege of working with in their journey, because it's like the way it feels to me is it's like taking something that feels frozen and static, as if our lives were a snapshot, and putting it into video form, coming into alignment with the idea that we are energy in motion, that we are living and changing and evolving and growing. So it infuses something that has felt in stagnation with vitality, to come back to that word, and give it just enough energy to start to evolve into whatever its next expression is. And it's not that we need to even get rid of anything, just like I'm thinking of, you know, the deeper alchemical work of waking up to our own true nature and our work with the ego. And I know you're a yoga teacher, and so many people demonize the ego and say, we're just going to toss this out. And it's like, we don't need to get rid of anything. Like, we just need to mature. That's all. Just continue to expand. It's a natural organic process. You didn't have to go from like, you didn't need to like get rid of your 10-year-old self in order to become your 11-year-old self. You just, or even the maturity that you evolved into at your 20 or 30 or 40-year-old self, like you just mature. And so I think what we're doing is, as more awareness is opening, more wisdom and understanding and compassion, which are almost, to me, compassion and wisdom are synonyms for all intents and purposes, and or for most intents and purposes, they're ways of supporting this natural inclination towards homeostasis with self. And so we don't need to be against anything. We can find that sense of this is an organic process and we're just nurturing it now with more understanding available to us.
Oh, I love this approach. And I'm thinking as we're talking, we just took it full circle. Like we put down the fight, built a bridge, identified the ways that it allowed for our survival, this bow and arrow, right? And then we built a bridge from that. And the next step, and as you're so beautifully tapping into compassion, the next step from here with food is like now with this new sense of how I would like to feel in relationship to food. Now identify for me what your day looks like. How do you feed this body from this set of beliefs? And now we've just come full circle, not again, I love this idea, not away from the self, but back into connection in a really new, compassionate way.
Absolutely. So thank you. So, and I'm like, I can feel the difference because I'm moving through this inside as we're speaking about it. Now I don't have that inner, what's the word? Maybe you used it earlier, but whatever that restrictive kind of, I'm thinking of like puritanical. Did you say that earlier?
I did.
Okay. That's what was living in my mind. It feels very like, you know, shut it down, do it this way. It feels like I'm closed in. And instead you've reminded me of, and brought me into a state of like who and what I truly am. And so now there's no have to's. Like that is the seat that wants to and craves, well, I want to eat this because I feel lighter. I feel more vibrant. I feel healthier. I feel more connected to the earth. So I wanted to just ask you then from that standpoint, are there, and maybe this is where it's different for each of us, but you know, I've been studying in our 300-hour training recently, Ayurveda, and looking at like how we eat for our constitution. And then, you know, there's all these different things from like vegetarianism to veganism to carnivore to keto to, you know, whatever the different, you know, methodology is. What is your relationship to the various methodologies? Do you, you know, certain ones that work better for certain people or that you lean on or don't? But I'm curious to get your thoughts on that space.
So as you were describing this kind of reclaimed, I want to, I get to, rather than I have to. Yeah. I love this kind of redefining calories. We have a very negative connotation with the word calorie. We splash numbers on our menus. Like we have really created this limiting relationship with energy. And a calorie is a unit of energy. And to reclaim this energetic exchange with food and identify that food is if food is this energy, this power, there's this empowerment that comes when I feed myself from a place of I get to, I want to do this, and I want it to enliven my body. Maybe sometimes I want it to bring comfort. Like, but when I come from this aligned space within myself, that's a really different relationship with that energy exchange or that calorie. I often get the question of what's the best diet or which set of rules work for which people. And I believe that there is an importance to therapeutic approaches to a diet, and to is continuing to be such a beautiful teacher for me in the space of how the energy of food intersects with the energy of our bodies. As you were asking the question, this story came to my mind. I was working with a client for a while, and she was vegan. And we didn't challenge the vegan restrictions, nor, I should be very clear, nor do you need to. You can come to a very holistically supportive and healthful space in many different arenas, as far as like the structure of how you eat. Anyway, that she was following a vegan diet and went on safari. She went on vacation with her family and was very nervous about this trip because there was probably on safari not going to be access to these like very high quality, expensive Whole Foods products that she was used to having access to. And so the first day of the safari, she said to the guide, "I'm vegan." And he said, "Okay." And the first night she had chicken on her plate and, or whatever, I'm remembering chicken, but whatever the meat was. And she said to the guide, "No, I'm vegan." And the guide was like, "Oh, okay," and changed it to the other meat product that was available at that time. And she's like, "What is going?" So the next day, same thing, like, "I'm vegan, so I won't." And they're like, "Okay," and gave her something else, you know, that was animal based. And by the third day, she was like, "Forget it." Like, these people are offering all that they have to offer me and trying so hard to make me happy and help my body feel good and energized for this day of safari. And they do not understand the concept that I would restrict a category of food. So to them, it's like, this is what the earth provided us. And this is what we, a translation to this sweet guide for what that meant, because his connection to food didn't have that. It was like, today it's this and tomorrow it's going to be what tomorrow is. And I often come back to that story, both in my approach with clients and in how I explore this question with clients. If we were to take the rules or even the descriptors away, like if you didn't have one word to describe how you ate, and every single day was an opportunity, like we were, what that look and feel like. And that can feel very scary at first for someone who operates well within that kind of a container. And yet it offers us this really beautiful like recognition over and over again with ourselves and with this earth that we're in connection with. And so that probably isn't the answer you're expecting, but that's the story that came to mind.
Yeah, no, I love that story. It's funny. I had this experience. This is going back to 2005. It was Hurricane Katrina. Came through, passed through Florida without much, you know, impact. And then it hit the Gulf Coast pretty severe in late summer, I think of 05. And remember feeling like, what can we do? How can we help? What do they need? And I created a yoga retreat to go over there and help in the recovery efforts. It ended up, you know, we're not the Red Cross. I'm a yoga teacher sitting here by myself in Florida. So what do? I pick up the yoga journal, like teacher directory, and I just go down. I look for New Orleans and, you know, some of the surrounding areas. And I just start calling, you know, yoga teachers. "Hey, do you guys need help? What do you need?" You know, just like totally random. And this one guy answered the phone. I mean, it's literally like the day after the storm. And he's like, "Hello?" You know, like you could hear, it sounded like it was chaos around him. And I was like, "Hey, you know, I want to help." He's like, "I'm trying to evacuate. Let me, you know, I'll try you back soon." You kind of think, I was like, "Okay, you know, click, no big deal." You know, keep trying down the line. So by the time this thing materialized, it took about 10 months. And by then, all the cameras left, a lot of the revitalization efforts ended. There was a lot of work still to be done, healing in that community. But that teacher called me back and he helped me to plan a trip. And we ended up, you know, getting support from a lot of the big yoga companies and publications, and ended up building a big retreat out there. And each day we did a different project. And one of the projects, they were each designed to work on a different layer of like life, from the earth to the body to the emotions to the heart. And one of them was working with the revitalization of the gardens of a senior center, because they loved being in their garden, but it got destroyed and they didn't have a lot of the manual labor capacity to work on it. And folks that did, that wasn't like top line priority. And so it just kind of went by the wayside. So we're like, we're going to build you an amazing garden. So we show up there like 20 yogis from all around the country with our shovels and, you know, all these plants we got donated and everything. And they're so happy. I mean, they're so, so happy. We go in afterwards to meet all the residents, and they're like, we have songs that we're going to sing for you, and we're going to give you food. And like, they were so unbelievably grateful, crying, singing, hugging us. And they're like, please sit down. We're going to serve you a beautiful meal. And then in comes buckets of Kentucky Fried Chicken. And half the people are vegan in the group. And this one yoga teacher that I was describing, he turns around, he looks at me and he goes, I have not eaten chicken in 20 years. And I'll be damned if I don't down this entire bucket right now. And I was just like, whoa, right? Like, he was eating it like he wasn't eating it because of compassion, and his compassion practice was so present in that moment. Like, what would ahimsa look like here? And he's like, it looks like eating the chicken. And that's how I heard your story. Like, it's not these hard and fast rules and practices. And to the degree that we have them, our relationship to them is really measured by our ability to adapt them as needed in the moment that we're in.
Oh, I love that story. And it's like this reflection of, most of the time, the way I can, you know, make these decisions can be really based on me and how I'm feeling that day. And I can be really nuanced and aligned and selective. And then when there's an energy exchange so beautiful from this community saying thank you in this way with food, like, what do I choose in this moment? That's going to look really different.
So different. And I can also understand people listening and being like, no, because what's in the food, and you're putting it in your body, and what happened to the chickens? And you know, I'm specifically thinking, I'll stay with the KFC thread, because I kind of want to go into this piece with you and get your thoughts, which is like, there's still a line, like, to some degree, right? Especially once it becomes more habituated, but like, our culture is sick, and the cruelty to animals, and like, how did this happen? Like, the processed foods weren't always a thing. And I believe, I could be mistaken, but I think it was David Perlmutter who I heard this from. And he was describing this experience of, we didn't always have these frozen foods, processed foods in our diet, in all the pesticides and everything that, you know, the preservatives, etc. And it was when it was, I think it was the Vietnam War. I could be wrong, but I think it was the Vietnam War, where it was originally the soldiers, I think it might have been even prior to Vietnam, that the soldiers got it passed through Congress, because all the food companies were saying, like, we want to do this, because they knew that they would be able to make a lot more money if they could, you know, put all of this into the food. And so the Congress was saying, no, they wouldn't legislate around it. But then when the soldiers needed the food to have preservatives in it in order to sustain while they were in battle, they allowed it just for that usage. Well, then ultimately what happened, I think it was then fast forward to Vietnam, that they were gone for so long that there was nobody in the workforce. And so now that actually supported the idea of women going into the workforce and away from this sort of conventional, the patriarchal structure of the woman stays home and the man goes to work. And now the women are going to work and the men are overseas in war. And part of that conventional role was provide a meal, make dinner, et cetera, et cetera. And we can even trace this back earlier to hunter-gatherer society when men, because of their physical capabilities, lent themselves more to being the hunters while the women were preparing what the men went and killed. And then as the brain evolved and humans started to develop instruments, the man could go out and be more efficient in their hunting. And so now they're using weapons that they made from these rocks and stones and tools. So now that freed up their time. So the women didn't have any expedition of time. They were still doing the same process. Well, the men could then go, we'll hunt. These men will hunt, and these men will create this and create this. And that was like sort of how they took place. And so these roles stood pretty much intact and became like normalized even as identities all the way up until we hit this point in we're at Vietnam. The women are going into the workforce. The kids are coming home. Now the women are going home, making meals on top of that. They're super stressed out to try to do both roles. And the first fast food billboard was a Kentucky Fried Chicken billboard that showed a bucket of chicken and like a woman feeding, like setting it onto the table for the kids with the words, women's empowerment or women's liberation. And that we've all been getting sick, and they opened up the green light for all the preservatives into the food. And here we are, you know, in large degrees addicted to a lot of the things that are in these foods that are making us sick, when it could actually not just be neutralized, but used to heal, like Hippocrates.
There's almost, it feels like existential, this reflection of how damaged our earth now is, and how that has impacted us. So not only has our system really not developed in a way to support our bodies whatsoever, creates far more confusion and illness and disease. And then also the very farming practices that we use on this planet are damaging us. And the more work I think we do as individuals in our healing, the more you connect to this kind of universal, I'm trying to search for a different word, but brokenness in how we operate in connection with our earth. My dad's side of the family lives on a farm in Ireland. And so I've always had this like upfront view of what a small farm can be versus what these kind of mass produced lands and animals have become, especially in the United States. And this is such a deep conversation that comes up in my office, and one that brings up grief and anger, that not only am I struggling individually, and I can trace that back to my table, but wow, the more I learn about this system as a whole, the more I see the ways that it in and of itself does not support me. And it complicates what it means to have access to food, especially, I mean, we live in a really amazing area for access to great products and land and farming. But there are places in this country where that is not the case. And so I think that this is such an important conversation. And my experience with clients is that it becomes more invigorating as your individual healing is occurring, because you're like, wait a second, what about all of these other aspects of the work that need to be done? And how can my dollars vote in this way? How can what I'm buying support this?
Absolutely. I had written a poem once, and it ended with this idea. I'm trying to remember how I worded it, but it was, choose wisely how you vote, not just with your ballot, but with your dollars and your decisions, because in the end, the future that we are writing holds no luxury of revisions. And that idea.
It's got chills. That's beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah. That, and actually part of that poem is about food, and it's about, you know, it was something like, to the extent of what I just shared, like I'm trying to remember that piece, but it was kind of going from politics. It's called Politics. And it's like, you know, it goes into this whole other piece around like what the food that gets us sick when it could be used to heal, But instead, the school lunches serve a meal that will ultimately lead us all to the clinic where we will stand in line for a dose of medicine to heal the symptoms of a broken system while the root cause goes untreated, a nation defeated. Unconscious of its own demise because it's too caught up in the guise of looking good on the outside. And it's like, what is our, that whole process, you know, thinking of, you know, the documentary What the Health, that both of those were so good, but What the Health, and like sitting there afterwards, just jaw dropped and dumbfounded, forget about like even the piece of like, well, this diet versus that diet. But really what I'm hearing you say now in terms of our relationship to the animals, to the environment, to our own health, and how that has been infiltrated by these mega corporations. And if you look at the merger and alliances between factory farms, big pharma, the agencies that are empowered to regulate that, the three-letter agencies that are regulated, the capture of those agencies by those big pharma companies, and then the government, the regulatory, not just the licensing and regulatory agencies, but the legislature, the senators, the ones that are actually voted into office that are really coerced and corrupted by lobbyists. That entire cycle, and then even the nonprofits actually as well. So if you know, it was showing like, first off, like where the money from big pharma goes, like most of it isn't even into pharmaceuticals that we as humans take, but being put into the animals. I forget what the percentage was, but a large percent of their income comes from factory farms because the regulatory agencies say, well, we got it. We have to take care of this, 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 and this. So make sure you put these medicines, quote unquote, if you're listening, into these animals. And then now we're ingesting not only the emotions and the treatment of those animals in the factory farms, but the pharmaceuticals that are injected into them. And then the food gets us sick and we go, well, how do we heal? And we look up, you know, well, let's look up American Diabetes Association or Susan B. Komen or American Heart Disease and Association. And they tell us what to eat. And then we're eating more of the thing that caused us to get sick. And then, you know, this is all getting greenlit by this process that's making these corporations richer, the people sicker. We're dying not only younger lives, but we're living unhealthier lives. So how do we break that cycle? How can we utilize this moment that we're in right now, having this conversation, to empower new awareness, new choices? How would you encourage people to empower themselves and where they source their food? And I want to say all this, and I want to drive it into like the most difficult context. Like you said, if you're in a particular geographical area, that might be easier. If you have a particular income, that might be easier. But where there's income disparity and access disparity, how do we have advocacy to make sure the knowledge of how to, but the capacity to as well?
This is just such a deep and one of the most meaningful, if not the most meaningful, conversation as a collective to be having, especially in this moment and what we're looking at environmentally with the damage that has been done. It's interesting because as you were reflecting, this is not a part of my story I often include, or even in my own reflection of how I got to where I am, pharmaceutical company between my junior and senior year. And I was in the R&D department and I was in high school. So they were like, you know, let's just have her do paperwork. And all I was doing that summer is going through essentially like Excel spreadsheets. The patients were numbered, for purposes of the studies. And I would just highlight who had the symptoms they were looking for. So I was just going through paper after paper of numbered patients highlighting symptoms in reflection of these drug trials. And I remember out of just sheer boredom, partially, but also like, what am I doing? And is this really how we serve? people who are sick. And so I forgot actually about how pivotal that experience was until you were just describing this whole system. And I think in many ways, that's why I was always somewhat skeptical of just a Western clinical approach and wanted to really explore outside of that. Like, how did we approach medicine before this was the way that we documented responses? And that being said, you know, for each person, it's different, like you said, based on what's feasible in my access and also in the income that I have to use on food. But the resources that I typically lean into, local farmers markets or markets in general, like mom and pop kind of style markets, are often a great place to start. Online, I recommend Thrive Market quite a bit for product ordering because they've already done a lot of the work for you in filtering down to products that are pretty thoughtful in their ingredients. And Thrive is more accessible, you know, regardless of where you are. Even in local farm markets, though, I'll say it's helpful to really talk to who's selling the produce, because that sometimes in and of itself doesn't secure that the produce is actually really thoughtfully grown. So those are, you know, a couple, I think, approaches to start with. But another thing I'll come to in session is, like, yes, it's a few more dollars. Maybe for eggs is a big example. Like, yes, maybe it's a little bit more per dozen for you to get the eggs that were really more humanely raised. And for your body, you're getting a far superior nutritional profile of that product. Grass-fed beef is significantly higher in omega-3, which are anti-inflammatory fats. Like, we know when we actually look at the nutritional benefits of higher quality food, that there's a benefit to our body. And so if we break it down in that way, you're valuing what matters to you in spending our money in that way. The other resource that I'll often use is the Dirty Dozen with organic produce. So if it's not feasible to get everything organic, maybe focus on those products that are most commonly sprayed or have the highest kind of pesticide content. And the Dirty Dozen changes, not much, but can change year to year. So that's a good resource. There was something else I was thinking too. Oh, where we're eating, restaurants that you're choosing to go to. Like, that's an amazing way to support local business, local, like, thoughtful chefs who source from local farmers. Like, the more we're just getting down kind of back into our environment and out of these big mass chains, I think you're getting closer to connection to the earth in that way, and also closer to the products that really serve you and that energy exchange with someone who really wants to be serving your body in the flesh as opposed to in the package.
Those are all such great recommendations. Yeah. Thank you for that. You had touched into this idea of, like, you know, thoughtful farming and, you know, what were the conditions like in which the animals are being raised, the getting closer to the source, away from the packaging, away from the big chains. What is your understanding from the preparation side, not the consumption side, as we've discussed already, but the preparation side upon maybe the impact of the consciousness of the place and the people that are, whether it's raising the livestock or growing the vegetables or, just in terms of the consciousness that's infused into the food that we eat. How do you hold that?
I think in this experience of food as an energy exchange, I was talking about this idea of calorie as a power, a unit of energy that empowers the body. There's an inseparable nature between the food, the biochemistry of the food, and the energetics of how that interacts with our being. And so to me, as I'm realizing, as I'm interpreting your question, they are one and the same. The quality of that food is inseparable from how it was produced and how it was raised. And the energy of that is interconnected in our being when we consume it. And so when I think of it in that way, there is no question that there must be an intentional approach to how we navigate growing, raising our food, because there's not a way to separate that. In order for a product to best serve our body and to have the richest profile, it must have been intentional, the energy that was infused into its growth. It's like expecting a plant to thrive in really poor soil. Like, we would never expect that. How could we expect a product to be really nutritionally dense when it didn't come from a source that energetically supported it?
So fascinating to visualize this continuum of energy. When, you know, we think of, when we talk about it in this way, it feels like so, you know, maybe esoteric for people to consume. Oh, what are the energy with which the person was infusing into this food? And it's like, okay, there go the yogis again, talking about the consciousness of it. And I love to pause with that and go like, well, let's unpack it then. Like, let's really look at that with our logic. And one thing that we've been talking about this whole time is that, like, the primary transference and purpose of this food is for energetic reciprocity and exchange, that a calorie, as you said, is a unit of energy. So energy is not a hokey thing. Energy is a real thing. This is the actual purpose of eating, is to support our energetic health. And we can feel it. We can feel when there's food that is of like higher vibrational frequency, when it's like in a restaurant, like you're saying, that's sourcing from local farms, the environment in which it was produced and prepared was clean and conscious, when it's served with intentionality. I just was recently eating at this as a local juice and kitchen, and just remarking with one of the servers there. It's like, you know, every time I eat here, I feel revitalized. I feel like literally like I can take a bite into this food and feel like it pings in my brain, like this feeling of lightness. And he said, you know, what's funny that you say, and I said, when the owner trained us, and the owner's the chef, he said, we are taught to prepare the food with the energy of love and to pray over it as we're preparing it. And he's like, so that's, I'm going to tell him that you said that. And I was like, yeah, I can feel that. And why I bring it up is not just to confirm this idea, but as with any other experience that we have in life, the energy we infuse it with impacts it. But in those moments when we don't find ourselves, for whatever reason, and with zero judgment, eating in the healthiest way, and I, by the way, I'm just caveating, like disclaimering, I should say myself, of like, there's so much cleanupness to happen here. So I think of it as like, well, okay, so when I find myself in that moment, if that is impactful, maybe one thing that I can do is that myself on the receiving end. So when the food is served, to take a moment and send energy into it, send gratitude into it, send light into it, send love into it, and visualize it enriching the soils of myself and my soul, and seeing the big connection that we're a part of and how it's going to give me energy to continue to serve. And there's something that we can do sort of on that back end of it, just not only on the front end, where we can intervene. And we've seen with Dr. Emoto's work what, you know, this sort of praying and healing and positive intentionality, his was primarily in liquid form, but I think that that would hold true in all, you know, forms of molecular structure. Agree, disagree? How do you receive that? No pun intended.
And I was thinking as you were talking, one of the practices, tangible practices that really embodies this in our own receiving, how we're receiving the food. I love this idea of giving gratitude, giving energy, because then we're elevating our own energy along with the food itself, is a vagus nerve practice. So something that's really in the forefront of is stimulating the vagus nerve as a way to optimize digestion. And I think it has been kind of woo-woo, this idea of like energy in our food and how we're receiving that. And yet science is really catching up, or maybe it's there in showing, no, our energetic state, our mental and emotional awareness of what's going on in that energetic exchange is very important. And there are physical differences in how we digest and utilize this food, this information, based on where our own alignment is in our own system. And so a very simple practice that I'll do with clients, especially when you're working on anxiety at the table, is to stimulate your vagus nerve before you start to eat. So bringing in that gratitude practice, like you were sharing. And then to stimulate the nerve, there are three main ways that you'll see in research. One is with the breath, humming. To stimulate, the nerve runs through the back of the throat, I should have mentioned. So along the spinal column, and you're stimulating at the back of the throat. So deep nasal breathing, like a yogic breath where you're breathing into the back of the throat, humming or gargling. And so I typically recommend feeling feet on the floor to really ground your system. Three deep nasal breaths before taking that first bite. And what you've now done is helped align your system, which is just as important as the energy of the food itself. And that really completes the exchange. And I really appreciate the reflection of like, yeah, life is imperfect. And we just identified this system is very imperfect. So there are going to be moments in an airport where you're not accessing maybe what you really want to or what you would hope would be the highest quality, and use your sense of this energy exchange, and that will optimize and change the way that you're assimilating the information from that food.
Thank you so much. And you cut out on one of the three vagal toning practices. So I caught essentially the Ujjayi breath. Second one, I received it as the invitation to Om, which is like a hum. So I'm like, go yogis with the their historical ancient insights. But what was the third one besides the breath and the hum?
It was gargling. Just not the most common of the three.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, and there's a few more I might offer that's really simple for people is if you. And I like this one because it connects to the mouth, which is obviously like where we are bringing food into our bodies through. But if you let the center of your tongue get heavy and you just drop that weight, that actually stimulates the vagus nerve as well and induces a relaxation response. And then when we are breathing, if we can let the exhales just get a little bit longer than the inhales, and we can, I like to try like a 4 in, 6 out. And do that 6 times for 60 seconds. And that 60 second threshold, we get a little vagus nerve reset. And there's lots of practices. I encourage you guys that are listening to just Google vagus nerve, you know, resets or vagal toning practices. And you can take this and run with it. I'm reading a book right now on polyvagal theory and therapy. I think it's Deb Dana, and then a guest I'm working on booking right now, so fingers crossed, we'll put it out to the universe, Dr. Ariel Schwartz, just wrote a book on polyvagal theory in yoga. And that's really fascinating because it can really support yoga teachers and practitioners in how to infuse their practice with a deeper understanding of polyvagal theory. So I'm planning on an entire episode just to this because I think it's so important to understand in all facets. But I will share with you, I'd never thought about it in relationship to eating. The ways from our conversation so far is how little I have understood about the way my other mindfulness practices could live alongside eating. It's just this sort of quarantined off, so primal. And I always think of myself as like a foodie. And that was the other thing with the family origin story is everything gets planned around food. So if we're, you know, it's the weekend or we're going on vacation, if it's even more, what are we eating tonight? It's like, that's the big event is the food, you know, and which is kind of cool in one sense, because It's like you said, it's social and we can connect and communicate. It's like this, I mean, food, right? I mean, wow, it's like this palette of diverse flavors that can get paired in like myriad different ways that are like light up our senses and give us energy, can be like the most enriching and powerful practice. And we can also create all of these bonds with that, that are substitutes for something fundamental that exists within us, where we outsource it to food. And so again, having that razor's edge practice of not like getting rid of it and shutting it down and not enmeshing with it in an unconscious or unhealthy way. And so an opportunity to bring conscious practice to places that can often just become so not just habituated, but in the case of that, it is primally habituated. I mean, it's like survival is not just like, it's not just we need food to survive. We're so wired to like, this is a need right away. And so something that you've presenced in your work is this matrilineal connection of like, you know, the mother line and how it gets wired in. I'm curious, Megan, if in your interpretation of this, does this go back to like in utero and it gets like mom's relationship to food when she was pregnant with us is what is setting the template for the nervous system, the energy, the emotion, the mental. I mean, I'm imagining she eats particular food. You're getting some impact of that. She's producing some sort of chemical cascade through her system that you're then organizing your whole nervous system and mental emotional landscape to sort of organize and regulate around that chemical set. I mean, wow, like what's getting inscribed before we even leave the womb in relationship to food specific? I'm not sure if did I cut out on you a little bit?
Like very end. I lost me.
That's okay. So what's getting inscribed in the womb based on mom's relationship to food?
So this connection through, especially the female line, by nature of how we come into this world as humans, is one of my favorite aspects in relationship with food, connection, nurturing, like that is our earliest connection to food. So her energy around the food, her food itself, that is our earliest knowing as a physical being. And it's interesting because I was reflecting back to the Kentucky Fried Chicken bucket and that said women's empowerment. Wasn't that the term that you said?
Yeah, empowerment or liberation. I'm trying to remember the exact phrasing, but it was to that effect.
And it's this messaging of like, maybe there's a liberation from the servitude that was, you know, feeling like it was part of food. But what about the empowerment of knowing exactly how to feed my body in connection to an earth that serves that? Like, there is just such a disconnect in how we could be empowering this female line energy that's passing through. Because then, yes, it's informing this life before it's even able to make its own choices. And so that just felt kind of full circle as you were describing the impact there. It's like the way that we speak about and treat female bodies is absolutely going to inform female body, this creatrix.
You know, it's wild being a male and we think of ourselves as like, well, I'm a man and you're a woman. But I want to remind every guy that's listening to this that you were raised inside of a female body as one with that body for the first 9 months of your life. And you didn't even realize you were separate for a while. Then you fed off of this body. You were emotionally, to healthier or unhealthier degrees, regulated and attached at an emotional level, whether secure, insecure, styling, to this body and this person, this human. And so every man is an extension of a woman. And of course, there's the seed of the masculine that ignites that process as well. And it's like, And so for every female to know there's an aspect of male in you. And I think this is the Taoist representation of the yang and the yin and the yang, and how we cultivate those aspects of our nature and not being so separated off ideologically that cuts us off energetically. And then if we were to extrapolate that out, the sense of the intrapersonal and the interpersonal, and actually see the ecological implications of this, I think it's profound, because we're all growing out of this earth. This earth itself has this consciousness to it that's producing all of these life forms. It's absolutely incredible over these last 5 billion years of this planet. You know, what has emerged from out of it is absolutely mind-boggling. And to think that in the name of sourcing our food, where it's become like profit over health, it's not just the health of the people that it seems to be impacting, but the health of the planet itself. And I'm thinking about like the cows and the ozones, and obviously, well, I'm just keeping it within food, but you know, there's so many other, you know, practices that are destroying our planet. I wonder what between food and the environment.
Well, following this mother connection, you know, the earth as this great mother, and we are extensions of the natural world as humans. And so there's this interconnected nature where we are inseparable from this great mother and this all of life produced from her.
Isn't it wild that, you know, we put everything into these compartments when it's actually a continuum? And another one of my many takeaways from this conversation has been the, again, reinforcement of picking up a piece of what I sometimes forget, that it's all consciousness. The consciousness in the planet is infused into the food, which is also infused by the consciousness of the human that impacts the consciousness of the person that is receiving it, which then spreads it. And so we're in this interconnected ecosystem of consciousness, as they would say in the yoga teachings of Vedanta, one without a second, that everything is fundamentally one thing, and how we treat any aspect of it will impact the entirety of it. And I think a big aha inside of this is that when it feels insurmountable, when it feels like we talk about the negative impacts on health, the negative impacts on the planet, on the various cultures and limitation to access, that these things that can feel so suffocating and insurmountable, that we are each empowered, and how we treat this vessel of our own unique self changes that dynamic tapestry, and then how we choose to support the businesses that have healthier practices and support the local, support the farmers markets. You know, I was just at farmers market this weekend, and I said to my daughter, you know, we're going to start changing our Sunday shopping. We had already like made plans to go out after. I said, moving forward, we're going to do farmers market first, so we don't go, oh, we can't keep the groceries in the car all day. So it's going to go, we're just going to leave it in the morning, do our shopping. We're going to support these local human beings to really like feel supported and sustainable and thriving in their business and in their lives. And that energy is going to go back into the food, so it's not lack produced energetically. And then we're going to go home. We're going to make our meals from that together and be in the kitchen and bond. And you know, yesterday we came home from school and we made dinner, and then we went out to a park with our dogs and just had a picnic and watched the sunset. And we looked at each other and we're like, my daughter's 14. And, you know, like, isn't this so much better than going home and like watching TV or something, you know? And so it was beautiful. And it just brings me back to like the simplicity of being alive and cherishing the people that we love and we're here with, and taking care of each other, taking care of our planet. And, you know, I had dropped her back home. It was our transition day. My kids, mom and I are separated for many years. So yesterday was our transition day and I got to keep her a little longer enough by request to watch the sunset together and do this. And I dropped her off and I sat in my car and I wrote this. I want to share it with you. It's a very simple little thing. And it just says, 100 years ago, pretty much none of us were here. 100 years from now, pretty much none of us will be here. So let's cherish the moments we have here. Let's be sacred stewards of this planet. Let's love our people. All people are our people. Let's remember that there is no risk greater than the ones we don't take. And let's be wildly fucking bold in living our lives with an uninhibited luster, without trepidation or apology. And that's what it's about. And why I wanted to invite you here, Megan, and support this is I see your advocacy. I know your heart. And I hope that this conversation serves in some way to spread these thoughts, not as a final ending place, but as a place to begin to think about things maybe differently, to inspire new ideas, to inspire conversations, new practices, and to create the possibility of new narratives being discussed amongst us. And if we can, you know, we won't tackle the entire thing through a podcast one day, but can we fully use our energy and service of being in alignment with the vision that we know is possible within our own lives and within the reach to the degree that it's in resonance for us, that's a life well lived.
Oh, so beautifully said. Thank you for sharing what you wrote. It was such a wonderful culmination of the conversation. And this idea that the relationship to food, if our relationship with one thing is a reflection of our relationship with everything, the relationship with food can be the most healing, empowering relationship in order to really serve us and serve our bodies in a way that maybe we haven't experienced yet. And just because we haven't yet doesn't mean it's not possible. And I so appreciated this conversation and where it went.
Yeah, me too. So, and I thank you for taking the time out of your life, your day, your practice, and being with us for this little snippet that we'll save here on the podcast so people can return to it and find it maybe one day down the road. And I trust it'll intersect with people when they're ready to receive what has lived in this conversation. And so with that said, I wanted to just, before closing, invite you to just to check in to see if there's anything that feels unsaid that would feel valuable to plant here.
I feel like we've really covered, like we really dove right in, and I just love how it organically unfolded.
Amazing. And where can people find you if they want to reach out for support in transforming their relationship?
Most of my information is my name, Megan Fahey RD. So website is Megan Fahey RD. My Instagram is Megan Fahey _RD. And I think all of my information will be linked at both of those places. I absolutely welcome outreach, questions. And if I'm not the best fit, I can try my best to guide you to resources or others in this space who can serve.
And a lot of people that listen to the podcast are not local to the area that you and I call home. So do you work with people virtually?
Yes. And depending on our work together, I may or may not be able to work out of state. There's state licensure specific to medical nutrition therapy, where nutrition coaching can extend across state lines. I do have a virtual program. It's self-guided and it's 6 modules. And that is an option for anyone who wants to dive deeper. It feels like you're with me, but they're not one-on-one sessions.
And this is fed well?
Yeah.
Amazing. So thank you so much. This reached places I was not imagining that the conversation would. And I love that about it. I love that when we just sit down with our hearts open and our minds open. And I think they're to the point that we've been talking about, that there is some sort of call it divine intelligence or whatever name you want to tag on to it that guides what is ready to come out into form. And I could really feel that present here. So thank you, thank you. Thank you for being here. So much gratitude. And for everybody that has tuned in and listened, thank you for being
here. Thank you so much. Yeah. I'm really excited for where it went and particularly who it touches as well.
Me too. And please, if you haven't already, please rate, review, like, subscribe, comment, all the things to support this show and its continued outreach. And until next time, be blessed.
Yeah.